Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. On our way to having a conversation, I want to get this very important underwriter in that we did a little bit at the top of the last hour, but I want to make sure they get their voices heard here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Whether you're a first or second-time home buyer in the city of Baltimore, they can help you access a home in the city. That's the Maryland Mortgage Program, 1-800-638-7781. That's 1-800-638-7781. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. It's right there. All the information will be there as well. Something that's been going on that has been talking about and thinking about and had several shows about over the course of the year, and I've just been reading and thinking about a great deal, which is the power of hip-hop in this country and around the world. Wherever you see a resistance movement take place, whether it's in the streets of Palestine or whether you see, we just heard Jihan Hafiz was on our show last half hour from Egypt. She's done incredible stories for realnews.com with hip-hop artists in Tahrir Square. It took place in Tunisia. It took place in Moscow. It takes place wherever resistance takes place among young people. And just as many people said that back in the 1960s, that soul music or the music coming out of the church was the resistance music that kind of spread across the land, that's even more powerful, it seems, in terms of what hip-hop is saying. It went to reggae, I thought the same thing, but went to hip-hop combined with those forces has kind of taken over, and then it's been transformed by the communities they've been in, and those communities have been transformed by it. So we're going to talk about all that this hour, and here's some music from around this country and around the world. With our guests. We have with us in the studio Dr. Jared Ball, who is author of the book, I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto. He's Associate Professor of Communication Studies here at Morgan State University, founder and producer of Free Mix Radio. Good to have you back in the studios, Jared.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Been much too long. For the first time in studio is Darius Wilmore. Darius is a graphic designer, author of the forthcoming book, Stereotyped, Hip-Hop's Unsung Graphic Design Heroes, Heroines, and the Oral and Visual Histories of the Rap Record, 1979 to 1989. Darius, good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Harabic Tubman, who is co-founder of Existence is Resistance and is the artist manager who manages Shadia and Low Key and participates. And the film just came out, Existence is Resistance. Whoa! Existence is Resistance, which is about a tour that was made by American hip-hop artists with Palestinian artists on teaching nonviolent resistance and power of change through hip-hop on the West Bank. And Harabic, welcome. Good to have you back with us as well.
Thank you so much. I actually have a guest on the phone with me as well.
Oh, you have somebody? So Mariam is there too?
It's not Mariam, actually. He can introduce himself.
Go ahead.
How you doing, Harabic? And thank you for having me on the show, Mark. This is Mortal Technique.
Mortal Technique?
Yeah, that's me.
Gotcha. All right. So, welcome. So here we go. So let me just start here. One of the things that we wanted to start this, I think, with, I think it was your idea, Darius, and I think that's just a good place to begin. The piece you suggested that we start with was Self-Destruction. Was that the one you said? So let's just hit that real fast. And play this for a bit, and then we'll come back to the conversation.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
Darius, so tell us why you wanted to start with this.
Well, outside of the fact that it's a classic track, it seems to be relevant to issues that are going on around today, well, around the world today, if not just in the United States. The title and chorus alone, Self-Destruction, you're headed for self-destruction, is as relevant as it gets right now, you know? And in terms of the United States and what's going on with the Occupy movement and so forth, and all the issues that are affecting, you know, young people, especially young people of color in the United States and so forth, it just, every time I watch the news, I hear that song in my head, and that song is 20-some years old, I think, and it just seems like things haven't changed, even though that they have moved forward. It seems like they haven't moved forward at all, and that song's still relevant, even all the lyrics, and they've got, like, seven or eight different rappers on that song. She played the whole song out, and they're all talking about youth, black on black violence, and so forth. It was an anti-violence song from 1989, and yeah, you can take the lyrics out, and just pick a lyric, and it still works and still relevant today. And you could probably be relevant to kids in, you know, Egypt or Tunisia as well, you know. So that's why I thought it was relevant for today.
And I'm curious, Jared, before we turn to our guests in Detroit, about why you think this particular form of music, this power of this music, has taken over kind of the soul of protest movements across the globe with young people.
Well, I mean, it is itself. Hip-hop has born out of struggle, born out of conflict and resistance to oppressive conditions. Even the rap that doesn't take an overtly political stance is still born out of that kind of foundation. So as it was, you know, exported around the world, people who find themselves in similar conditions, you know, took it up and started using it in the way that poor people here use it. I mean, the emphasis on smaller collectives, on less technology or less musicianship is not, I don't mean that in a negative way, is born out of a necessity of a particular material condition. A lot of people could pick it up and start emulating it a lot easier than they could, say, you know, a 15-piece Earth, Wind, and Fire band or something like that. I mean, so as you know, I mean, it makes sense. And because there is so much oppression that continues to go on all around the world, it continues to inform and become a great source of expression for those who need to have it. And the only thing that I mean, I love self-destruction and what they were trying to do. The only thing that I would say in terms of today that I would like to see, and that I prefer, at least in my own preference for what I like musically, is the emphasis being on what is being done to us as opposed to what we're doing to ourselves. At the end of the day, self-destruction, and I don't mean this in a negative way, is ultimately kind of a conservative song, in that it's, you know, like sort of like a, I don't know, simply put, a narrow nationalist song saying, you know, we have to take care of ourselves, as opposed to some other music that I am more inspired by, particularly today at least, that says, no, it's not that we're doing it to ourselves. You all are doing it to us. There is an oppressive condition that is being imposed on us. So I don't know the sister's work yet. I'm anxious to hear what she has to say and what she's done. But I'm very familiar with Immortal Technique's work, and it's a pleasure to be on with him as well. But it's his stuff that I think, you know, the Martyr album, I'm rocking that today. I mean, it, you know, this is, and he's saying, I mean, to me, I hear that message a lot more clearly. Like, you all are doing something to us, and we have a problem with it, and you might not like our response.
Immortal, go ahead.
Well, I think I appreciate the brother's words, and I think there's nothing wrong with having a dual conversation, not just what they're doing to us, but what we can do in response to it as well. You know, the people that ruin the community, the individuals that like to marginalize people's political messages in order to then make excuses for stealing their natural resources in the third world or whatever other perversion of economics they've decided to come up with can be, you know, tangible in a song in many different ways. But I think unless they take the dual aspect, not only of pointing out what's wrong, but also of taking personal responsibility as a community and honestly coming to terms with the fact that, yes, like I said before, the people that ruined this aren't going to be the ones that fix it. You know, the same oppressive system is not going to be the one that all of a sudden has an epiphany about human rights and then decides that people's lives are now worth more than the bottom line of a profit margin, which never happens and has never happened in terms of a corporation which pretends to be a human being. So I think at some point, you know, you can have two of those things, not only the discussion about history, but also that in itself then becomes a mark of personal responsibility, because I think once people understand the history of a political conflict or even an internal struggle, for example, for a Latino population or a so-called Latino population to then embrace the struggle of indigenous people as they begin to realize that they themselves are more of an indigenous people and they share a lot more in terms of their roots and in common with African people than they could have ever been taught before in terms of their racist society. At some point, we begin to realize that we have more in common than we do apart. We begin to stop alienating ourselves by getting lost only in our struggle and being able to learn from other people's struggle. You know, if you're here in America and you're crusading for civil rights, then you might want to study what happened in Northern Ireland or what's happening in Palestine now or other places. And if you're from Palestine or you're from some of these other places in Southeast Asia or the Middle East where you see human rights violations rampantly, where you see the oppression of individuals, well, then remember that at some point, you know, the Middle East was itself an imperial power under the caliphate. What was the decay and the downfall of this that then broke it up into a series of third world nations that could be picked off easily? This is obviously a lot of work for the average hip-hop fan, but to be honest, it does spark in the minds of people that choose to accept this path for their own in terms of their own education. And I think that if you put it in an aggressive manner and you make it cultured and it sounds good, then, you know, it becomes a learning tool that is also very, very easily transferable into the underground, or even, I would say, you know, mixed show mainstream stuff that's a little bit different, that has an edge. You know, it's not necessarily top 40 pop, but then again, anyone who's doing this type of music realizes that, of course, that's not in anybody's interest who controls a recording industry to have this type of information be thrown out there.
So,
sorry for the long answer.
I mean, that... But I, you know, one of the things that strikes me, and folks, let me first encourage people to join here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and comments. Is that, you know, any genre of music has its kind of popular sound that has no very special social political meaning, but it's the popular sound, and then the part that does have a social and political meaning either was the root of it. Or if it wasn't the root of it, it becomes part of it, and it becomes an important piece of it that goes out to the rest of the world. I mean, so it's not just one thing. But going back to the root of it, I don't think, maybe to say what you all think, that it's a mistake, that it's an accident, I should say, that the power of this music that forms the heart of a social protest movement throughout the globe started in the black world in America. I mean, this is what gave birth to it.
Sure.
I mean, it first hit me as I went through driving. Let's see, you see it in the, you're going to a trailer on the res in the middle of Wyoming, and there's a big picture of Tupac or a Public Enemy sitting on the trailer walls, or you can see things in the downtown Kathmandu or wherever it is.
Anywhere.
Right?
No, I mean, but I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Jared. Then we'll go back.
No, I was just saying very quickly that part of what makes hip-hop so popular around the world is not only its genius and its brilliance and its power, but it's also the fact that what black people have produced as a cultural expression has always been the United States' main popular culture or mainstream popular culture cultural fare. So the fact that the United States is the singular empire in the world and able to export versions of its pop culture to the world, it has exported and made popular a version of rap music and hip-hop culture that largely serves its political interests. Now, there are, of course, crevices and challenges to this, but that's obviously the main goal. I mean, and we maybe can come back to this, but, I mean, this is even something that Hillary Clinton said so overtly just a little bit ago in reference to the State Department using rappers to send around the world, as was discussed in Al Jazeera and elsewhere. So, but there's, of course, a long history of that. So that's why I think, you know, obviously, and as Max Roach, the great, you know, legendary jazz drummer, said himself of rap music, that he could hear the revolution in the drums. So there's something about just the sound and the sort of stripped down brilliance of it all. And, of course, I think globally speaking, again, this is not to be condescending or at all, you know, hostile, but I think it takes a different kind of background and a different kind of ear to hear the revolution in John Coltrane than it is to hear the revolution in Public Enemy or any traditional, you know, rap music beats. So I think that's one of the reasons why I had that appeal. Then, of course, you hear the overtly radical language on top of it that doesn't take any, you know, depth of understanding to catch up to, and people are, again, feel it. So that has caused, I think, an even greater need of the powers that be in this society to export a version of rap music that speaks against the revolutionary trajectory that it is, you know, tended to take when left on its own, which is what all radical expression or all oppressed communities' expression tends to take when left alone. So in that regard, it's no different than the cultural expression of oppressed communities anywhere in the world. It has to be altered in its popular form.
Anybody want to jump in on that, Darius, or before we go back up to Detroit?
Just that, you know, it kind of what Jared is saying, there's something inherent in the beat. It's just the rhythm, you know. It's just that beat. I mean, if you go back to the early '80s, you know, Run DMC, Suck MCs, it was just a drum track with these guys rapping over it, and that in itself was revolutionary. You know, it was a dividing line between the Sugar Hill Gang, Curtis Blow, all the R&B artists of that time, and then them. They were like the meteorite that killed the dinosaurs, you know? And it's just this track. It's just a drum track. And it's, until this day, it's one of the most slamming tracks, in my humble opinion, that's ever come out in hip-hop. It's kind of machine-like now. It sounds like, you know, it's a bit of robotic, made on a drum machine. They weren't sampling stuff back then, you know? So you can tell it comes right off of like a rolling drum machine or something like that. But
any party will get live or as soon as it hits.
Yeah, man. Yeah, right. You throw that track on right. And it's done. It's yeah. done. And it's just two guys.
It now. Right.
We should have put it on the list. You know, so there's something about that beat that is the start of it. You know, like he was saying, the revolution is in the drums. So there's something just in the DNA of it that almost you can't even articulate. That as soon as you hear it, it just grabs a hold of you.
So, go ahead, Warren.
Very revolutionary rhythm. And I think one thing that's interesting that I'll just add on to what was just brought up is that during that time of development of early hip hop, it really didn't matter what you rhymed about, whether it was an individual who was a so-called party MC or whether it was the griot or the truth teller or the street rapper that was sitting here giving lessons on life like Melly Mel in The Message. All of these brothers back in the day, or I should say the large majority and quite substantially, and this is not me using assumption, this is just truth, a lot of these brothers, a huge percentage more of them, actually understood the lessons of hip-hop as a culture rather than just the music. It was more than just rap music. It was centered around a culture, and rap was simply one of the elements of this culture. The other one was graffiti writing. There was b-boying, DJing, and then, of course, knowledge of self being the fifth element, the understanding of where all of this comes from, the reality that, you know, if you have these lessons, that it does become more than music. Then you become able to interpret how this really affects and how this is a reclaiming of a lost culture or lost aspects of our culture. If you look at what happens to Black and Latino people, the decimation or the destruction of our religion, of our relationship with our women, of our diet, which is why there's heart disease and all sorts of type 2 diabetes. I mean, this is not to get too technical with the aspects of it, but without having the knowledge of self of who we are, then we do lose the cultural aspect of hip-hop, and then we end up with just music that can be manipulated. You know, entertainment can be used for a variety of different reasons. You can ennoble people with it, you can educate people with it, but you can also placate people with it. You can also pacify people with it. And I think more often than not, what happens with the position that hip-hop is in now is that at some point people had a conversation in a corporate office that had nothing to do with the people that originated the culture and said, listen, what really makes more money? And what does this element have anything to do with this? You know, this isn't affecting the bottom line. I don't care about a prison program or this being used to help wayward youth in the street. I like the example of the wayward youth. So it's not more racism, it's more placism. This is the happiest state that I'm glad to see you in. In other words, me projecting the image and being a caricature of what it means to be Black or Latino is now more fashionable to the people that are corporately in charge of what hip-hop is an example to be. They're not threatened by you because you have a gun or because you're talking wild and crazy on a record or because you brag about how many drugs you have. That's the type of brother that they know how to deal with. When you come out and you start saying things that have historical truth in them, when you start the conversation or the debate about where we've come as a nation, or even simple things, immigration. Well, you can't steal half a country from people and then build yours on top of them and then pretend that they're illegal human beings. This creates the type of brother that they do have a problem with you. But saying, all right, well, now I have to have a different conversation because I can't pawn this individual off with just money like some, you know, Yahoo, Yasa boss, you know, pickaninny imagery of an unintelligent artist that can be taken advantage of. Now it's not just about the art and the music, because all that is irrelevant if you can't control the voice that uses it. You know what I mean? What good is it to be able to have all these great rhythms and be in control of everything you know, in terms of the rhythmic sound or the sounds of it, if you control none of the business of the music, which is kind of what I think the independent era has been able to usher within the artist.
Well, if you take it,
So whether it's Coltrane or whether it's KRS-One or any other, if these individuals don't control how their music is used and they have no fundamental control of the masters, you know what I mean? These are conversations that I've had with Chris and with Chuck, saying, "Hey,
but
man,
wait a minute, if we take it to let's say what's happening around the globe right now with the power of hip hop. We don't have anything queued up that Abir was going to be with us tonight, but she couldn't be with us. Who's a Palestinian hip hop artist who's been part of that hip hop movie that was made about the Palestinian resistance movement. That there's something that because nobody wants to record them and make $1 million, nor they want to record the young people in Tahrir Square who are just putting it out there. But they've become the rhythm of their movement. They've become the rhythm of, and then you hearing the mix, the hip-hop beats that come out of America with the beats of the Arab culture, and you even hear them being interviewed and how they pull in the works of great African-American revolutionary and other authors along with their own, and they meld them. So something new and explosive has kind of erupted out of all that. That I don't think we've ever really seen. That really,
right. Something new and explosive blew out of hip hop, and look who controls it now. That's what I'm saying. That at some point the conversation becomes, all right, well, how do we become the preservers of this culture? How do we make sure that it doesn't become bastardized the way every single other art form that we produce did, whether it's reggae or whether it's rock and roll or whether it's hip hop?
What?
Harabic,
go ahead.
I'm gonna chime in real quick and just. So it's Harabic from Existence is Resistance, one of three founders. And basically, being Palestinian, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we do out there and what I've seen in Palestine. And one of the first hip-hop Palestinian groups that came out, DAM, D-A-M, actually learned English and learned about hip-hop from seeing a video of Tupac running from the police. And they were like, this kind of reminds us of us, but running from the Israeli military, you know. And from that, they started looking it up. And, you know, they found Public Enemy, Biggie. They started learning about hip hop in America, and it inspired them to want to use that form of resistance, you know, rather than having to be out on the street, especially now that we've got all these social media outlets to use to put our word out there. So what our organization does is take artists from here and from Europe and the UK and take them out to the West Bank. We've been to Gaza once. It was a lot harder. We took M1 from Dead Prez, Marzi, and Low Key. And we basically go around all the refugee camps and teach them, well, M1 was teach them about the African Liberation Movement and where hip-hop came from, and I think that's a big, important part that they need to know. In Palestine right now, it's like the birth of hip-hop. It's like when you go out there, they're breakdancing in the streets, you know what I mean? And all that's beautiful, and it's also, to me, I always say that it's so much more powerful for them to be able to put out a video on YouTube where 10 million people could see it rather than having to throw a stone at a tank and get shot in the face, you know what I mean? No one's really going to hear their story like that. But it's also just as important for them to understand where it came from, and that's why we do these tours out there and these workshops, you know, so that they still respect the where it came from and the form of hip-hop. So, you know, we spoke to you, Mark, just before we went with M1, I believe,
right,
from Death Prez. And ever since he's been back too, I mean, we've been traveling. We actually did a tour as well, sorry, in 2011 with some other artists, but we've been back traveling with our film, which is called Hip Hop is Bigger Than the Occupation, and it just shows you their 10-day journey through the West Bank. And M1's been talking to youth out here because, you know, a lot of people kind of came back to him and said, well, why are you out there? And we got, you know, issues out here in our own hoods. And, you know, and he made that connection. And then especially because he's been out there and worked with the kids, you know, and seen where they're coming from, it's a lot more powerful for him to be able to talk about it. Again, I mean, Tech is another person that we've been trying to get out there. We're hoping to get out there this year. And, you know, I mean, that's the kind of artist that we want to be able to talk to the youth, you know.
So, we have to get a very brief break and come back. On the way out, we're going to play, just for those of you who have not heard him before, since you just joined us, Stephen, for the first time, a little bit of Immortal Techniques as we go out Peruvian cocaine. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm on the border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty. Dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms. And if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms. So I pray to Jesucristo when I go to the mission. Process the cocaine paste and play my position.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands. For workers must come.
Conversation. This is Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily contents on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We are joined here in studio by Jared Ball, author of I Mix What I Like, a Mixtape Manifesto, Associate Professor of Communications here at Morgan State University, founder and producer of Free Mix Radio. Arabic Tubman is co-founder of Existence is Resistance, artist manager who manages Shadia and Low Key. Immortal Techniques is with us also from Detroit. And in the studio here, Darius Wilmore, graphic designer, author of the forthcoming book, Stereotyped, Hip-Hop's Unsung Graphic Design Heroes, Heroines, and Oral and Visual Histories of the Rap Record, 1979-1989. And Darius, what were we just listening to coming in?
A song called Walking. By Anika, a Nigerian rapper, singer, kind of in the vein of like Lauryn Hill kind of deal. And that song, I have not been able to find the lyrics to that song. So, and you can tell her in the chorus, it's kind of hard to kind of figure out what she's actually saying. But I happened to stumble upon her in the Barnes & Nobles one day, and they were playing the whole album. The album was pretty good, and I heard that song. And something about, you know, it's God is sufficient for you. Don't go astray. Yeah, I could pick out certain words coming out of it, you know. And I just thought this is really, 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 really powerful. Then, of course, I went to YouTube and watched the video, and she's, you know, in the ghetto with a bunch of people walking, you know. And she's telling them not to give up, to keep on walking like I'm walking. And I just thought that was pretty, that's pretty heavy, you know. And I spent the whole day, friends will tell you, I spent the whole day playing that song in heavy rotation. I just didn't stop all day long, man, you know, so. I kind of fell in love with that song, so, and the message, kind of the message that I think it has. I don't know if you've heard that before, Jared. Have you,
no,
you
I'm
found
not.
The okay?
No.
So I'm looking for the lyrics. If somebody's got them, man. I was on Google, man. I couldn't find the lyrics, though.
So, let me ask you this question, Jared, because we were talking during the break about a bunch of things. Mm-hmm. You two were talking about what you both said at the very top of the show. Maybe we can get back to that in a minute. But you're also saying there's a nuance, a difference between what Immortal Techniques was saying, a little bit about an analysis of what the industry is doing with hip-hop. And throw your take out there.
Well, I mean, I just think it helps, for me at least, my perspective is that it's not just about money. And, of course, money was only invented to maintain social order in the first place, right, to make people without what you want to trade with you. And so the question for me is it's not that the corporate world is saying we just want to make money and therefore we're only going to put out what sells. I mean, if they promoted Immortal Technique the way they promote any number of other mainstream artists, I think he would sell just as well. I think Public Enemy's, the point we were making off the air was that Public Enemy was enormously successful and to this day resonates around the world, even though they haven't had a major hit in 20-some years, precisely because, as Chuck D told me once in an interview, that their success was an accident. They just happened to be label mates with the Beastie Boys, and the label needed somebody to send out on the tour, and they sent Public Enemy, and the next thing you know, the whole world has got their fists up talking about Fight the Power. And then the corporate world, the imperial world, had to reorganize itself to promote a version of rap music that would be more to its liking. So that's what I think is the issue, because they could make just as much money with any number of other artists. And just very quickly on this point, Malcolm Jamal Warner and Davey D once recorded this panel where Malcolm Jamal Warner from The Cosby Show was on, and he was talking about his experience with Malcolm and Eddie, the TV show he done later, I think, with the WB network. And he said he went to the producers and said, basically, can we create a better version of Black Men for TV? Mm-hmm. And the producers, he said, no, well, this is what sells. This is what's hot. And then he said, well, let me just remind you that, you know, whatever you think of The Cosby Show, and I have my own serious criticisms of it, but it did promote a different version of blackness, of black, in this case, manhood. And he just reminded them that, by the way, that was the number one show in the world, and they didn't have a problem selling that. So why would you then turn around and say, you know, nobody would argue that Malcolm and Eddie was anywhere near as successful as The Cosby Show? And I think the point that he made, and with which I agree, is that the issue isn't money as much as it is social order. And social order is destroyed if black people, in this case, see themselves in a different way, and if oppressed people around the world see themselves in a different way. And as we've already had in this conversation, the whole world is still looking for the politically radical left of center artists like Immortal Technique and Dead Prez and others who, without mainstream push, are relatively well known around the world and would be far more well known if they didn't have to compete so much everywhere they went with the popular image of rap music that's dominated by a corporate mainstream, which is, I think, again, a necessity, a political necessity. The very last point I make about this is that the major record labels, the big three, even the biggest one is a subsidiary of a much larger international conglomerate. UMG, Universal Music Group, is only about 14%, which is not insignificant, but it's only 14% of Vivendi. So Vivendi does not need to, is not going to survive or die just on Universal Records. So my point is that if they wanted to, they could allow for another crop of artists to become just as popular as their stable crop is. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't suit their political bottom line. It doesn't support their economic bottom line. And those with whom they're associated, in their political class. So that's just the one point I just wanted to make, that, or at least for us to consider, at least that I like to argue, is that also because I want to focus on not money making, but the need for those in power to maintain social order, to keep us in line. And that's done in large part by, as Immortal said a minute ago, keeping us entertained by mindlessness and keeping young, potentially politically radical people away from what would inspire them in that direction. Because everybody my age who listens to rap music always points to Public Enemy and others as bringing us into a political consciousness. Yeah. And that's something that has to be protected against.
So,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Immortal Technique. I want to ask Darius a question about that as well, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I agree largely in part, but I think a question that's important to ask ourselves is how much change do these companies really think that people are going to have? You know what I mean? People ask me this question all the time. How come you're not dead yet? You know, you say all these very radical things. You speak a lot about truth that people would like to not hear. And I say, well, you know what? When people start de-investing in their funds, when people start boycotting completely and they start having millions of dollars worth of loss, then they'll consider it an issue. And then that's when they really try to come after you. Another thing is, basically without economic freedom, you can't have political freedom in a capitalist society. So I tell people that in order for us to maintain that, I'm not saying that it's the only thing. I'm not saying that corporations aren't bothered by the political aspects of what they do. But if they can find someone they control, they have no problem making that money. I think the difference is that with independent and revolutionary artists especially, that they want more control over what they can say. They want creative control, and they know that when they have the reins of the business, that that equals even more creative control and more of the control over how their product is marketed and how it's put out to people and how it's presented, which I think really makes an end result of the difference in between how it's absorbed by a population and especially a population of young people.
Jared, you want to say real quick?
I would just say the only thing I would say to slightly disagree with you, Immortal, is that I think you answered, I would argue, I would put enter into evidence your own track, the Últimas Palabras track, if I'm saying that correctly, off the Martyr album, which everybody has to get. I mean, this album is dope as I don't know what. But in that track, and I'm not going to ruin it for those who haven't heard it yet, but in that track, I think if people listen to it all the way through, that answers the question as I would answer it. In that, other words, that we haven't produced a movement that gives Immortal as a political leader the kind of constituency that would make him the threat that he would be if he had that. And I think that's the only difference that keeps him from that crosshair and many others like him, is that we haven't developed the movement that would give him the kind of political power and constituency that would make him much more of a threat than he currently is. And some of us are working on that.
And I want to get to the phones here. People are calling in. I want to get them in conversation. But you said one thing. We'll go to Andrea, then Darius, a different Darius on the phone. But Darius, one of the things you used the word crosshair. Mm-hmm. One of the things you and I were talking about earlier today on the phone was this with Chuck D and the young black man in the crosshairs and how that became this graphic symbol of hip-hop that has never gone away and just struck.
Yeah. I'll be brief so you can get people in on the phone. The one thing that Public Enemy had that a lot of people didn't have at that time, I mean, they were big fans of Run DMC and The Clash. Public Enemy is a combination of their love for Run DMC and the punk rock group, The Clash. Run DMC had a great look and they had a great sound, but Public Enemy took it 360 degrees. Right, they had the lyrical content, Chuck D's voice, Flavor Flav is, you know, Bobby Bird, you know, Chuck is James Brown. They had the Sonics, which sounded like they were from the future at the time. It sounded nothing like it. And when you play it back now, you realize they were all James Brown samples. They were sampling James Brown records, but it sounded like they were sampling stuff from the future. But Chuck had a graphic eye, right? A graphic designer. And he was a graphic designer by education. He has a degree in it. And he created that logo. And when he did that and put that out there, not only did it represent young black men in the crosshairs of a gun, in America's gun scope, it ended up transcending just not just them, but rap music and hip-hop, and then it went out to around the world. I think, like I was telling you earlier, I've seen pictures of people in other parts of the country, I mean, other parts of the world that are involved in protests, and they've got a Public Enemy t-shirt on, or they've got a flag with the Public Enemy young man on the crosshairs symbol on it. And I don't think anybody's done that other than Chuck. And I was telling you earlier, Paula Scherer, Milton Glaser, Paul Rand, Saul Bass, legendary graphic designers, legendary. And they've never done anything that has transcended their profession, the art world, the design world, to become a symbol of resistance to oppression, like that logo for Public Enemy. It doesn't even belong to them anymore. You know, it doesn't belong to them anymore. It belongs to whoever is in a fight for
right.
Freedom.
And it's funny how those things can take hold. There was this Israeli guy who made this picture of his mouth open, screaming. Nobody knew where it was, just picked up on the web, and it's become the symbol of resistance across the globe because it just got picked up, and it is, you know. Let me go to the phones here and come back to all four of our guests because I want to get back to Harabic Tubman and talk about what this movie is saying to the world about hip-hop is more powerful than the occupation. I want to get to the essence of that in the course of this conversation as well. But let's first go to Andrea in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was just going to make two, like, quick comments. Like, I think, you know, the energy, just as you guys were saying, you know, it's in the drum, just like when I used to take African dance class. The drum has so many messages. And no matter what type of is, you know, if it's East Coast, if it's West Coast, if it's another country, that the whole drum and bass line kind of differentiate, you know, you from like your party music to kind of what, because, you know, there's intensity and emotion, you know, behind that drum, because, you know, you're feeling that pain and you've got it going out there. So it's conveyed through your music. So I think, you know, no matter what country it's, before you even hear anyone speak, you know, you hear certain songs and you just hear the music. You're like, oh, yeah. You know, you start rocking your head. It just brings out those certain emotions automatically. And that's why, you know, like some people that start out their career and they're great. And then later on down the line, you're like, oh, they've gone soft. it's not necessarily they've gone soft, but that emotion, that intensity, that fire is not there anymore. You know, like you hear people make that comparison with Jay-Z. Well, of course, he had the emotion. He was oppressed. He was living in the projects. He saw people getting shot. He saw people on drugs. You know, now he doesn't see that side anymore. So I think that's kind of what the differentiating is. And then also my other last quick comment is that, you know, it's sad that corporate America, but, you know, it's true. It's not in their best interest to promote it because obviously it would kind of change the skew of things. If you have something that's positive, obviously, if it's not going to be promoted on MTV or any of those channels, because then they're going to cut into their advertising dollars. Then it's going to cut into any of their substations that they have out there. And so, you know, down. So it's better to, unfortunately, to sell the negative, to sell the things that, you know, because then it goes into advertising dollars. It goes into sales. Right. So, all right.
Angela, thank you so much. I appreciate the comments. I think the way it's always easier and better for corporate America to sell an outlaw than a revolutionary. I mean, you can sell an outlaw because that's you can put outlaws in jail pretty easily. You know, I mean, it's just so outlaws are easy to put.
They just kill revolutionaries.
So I mean, I think that there's a reason why that the outlaw image is always allowed in music, but the political image of resistance is not allowed. You know, I think 410-319-8888. Let's take another caller in here, Darius, a different Darius. You're in the car.
Hello.
Hi, Darius. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Very well, man.
So, in listening to a lot of the comments, I'm interested to know if any of your guests have been following the discourse that's been going on in the jazz community about the actual term jazz being one that represents an oppressive and derogatory reference to what is now being or attempting to be referred to as Black American music, or abbreviated BAM. There are a few artists, you know, Nicholas Payton, a fine trumpet player from New Orleans, has done a lot on his blog about this, and some of the artists who've been involved in panel discussions recently, like Gary Bartz from Baltimore, and other artists, Ben Wolfe and Oren Evans, have been really vocal and very, very articulate about their position on this. It's interesting from my perspective to see the discourse about it, because there are a lot of us in the jazz community who've, you know, gone back and forth about the terminology, and you know, some folks who would prefer to stay away from it altogether because, you know, as like Duke Ellington used to say, it's all music. And but I'm interested to know if any of your guests have been following along with that. And also, okay, I just recently read an article that had been written in, I believe it was the New York Times, don't quote me on that, or maybe the Washington Post, but when the Thelonious Monk jazz competition, the piano competition, was held the year that Eric Lewis and Oren Evans competed, there was an article about a recent winner of that competition, and it's an interesting discussion about the racial component of corporate marketing within the jazz industry. And it was pretty telling and pretty disturbing to read the whole article.
All right, well, let me jump in, just because we're running out of time. I do want to get back to Harabic. Don't let this piece go about hip-hop and the occupation. But, Jared, you were nodding your head as you were speaking.
Just very quickly, I participated in an interview with Nicholas Payton a couple of weeks ago with my godfather, Tom Porter, in D.C., and his point is that he doesn't even use the word jazz anymore, neither one of them, I think, at this point. And my godfather says it's African-American classical music. And in part, it's because of a lot of what I think is an important argument to still have about hip-hop is that, without saying that hip-hop can't be performed by anybody in the world, I think it's important to remember that it is a Black American, African in America cultural expression, and has a particular origin in that community. And there's nothing wrong with it highlighting and appreciating that, as I think the sister said M1 was doing around the world. So, and I think what has happened to jazz is an instructive lesson for what those of us in the hip-hop community can see happening with hip-hop. So I would encourage any of us to get more involved with that.
Well, this is what this Darius brought up. And what you just said is Christopher Mill for another show.
Right, right.
This is the focus on that would be a really good, interesting hour and mm-hmm. play some music and really wrestle with that.
And by the way, while the Cornel West Theory out of D.C. named their last album, The Shape of Hip Hop to Come, after the Ornette Coleman album, The Shape of Jazz, something like I'm probably messing that up, but they got that. They were making that point about hip hop and jazz being connected. Yeah.
And Harab, before we run out of time, we have about 6 minutes left in this hour. I wanted you to talk a bit about the film that's just come out and talk about what it means that hip hop is stronger than the occupation. Talk about what all that means.
So we never expected to actually make a film, but I want to shout out the filmmaker Nana Dankwa, who's originally from Ghana. Who came with us and just documented the trip. And then we sat together and went through all the footage and ended up with, 104 hours and broke it down to an hour and a half. And it's pretty powerful. I never thought that I still get shocked. Like, I was in Chicago last week showing it for the third time in Chicago. And we had, 200 people there, and half of them were, I would say over half was youth. Under the age of maybe 16, 15. And, the first four rows were just crying, like, throughout the film. I would say a few years ago, I don't think anybody would have come to really see a movie or a documentary that people that young about Palestine. The power of it is because of the music, and like they were saying earlier, it's all in the beats. I mean, it's like Shadia Mansour, who happens to be my younger sister, is one of the first Palestinian female MCs that... She's performed all over New York, actually all over the United States, and people don't need to understand what she's saying to feel her or to feel the music. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's how this film comes across. Because it's through music, the youth's attention span isn't always as much as we can tolerate, but they, in between what's going on, in daily life there, between, us getting shot at, by the Israeli military coming into the refugee camp in the middle of the night and us being on the roof watching them, then you've got these concerts and it kind of lifts you up again. And I think it all comes back to the music and how powerful music can be with any culture from every country. It's a global language. I don't think you need to understand the words to, even though the words are very important, of course, like we said, but I don't think... connect it. What we try and do is connect the youth, and connecting them through music, I feel is probably one of the most empowering things I've seen so far. The film, it really, you should go and see it. We're showing it in New York actually on February 3rd at the Brett Forum. There is a trailer on YouTube. You could put Hip Hop is Bigger Than the Occupation or Existence is Resistance. It will be available, we hope, by the end of the summer on DVD. And people have wanted to put it into schools. I mean, it's educational, but it's also very empowering. And like I said, I really feel that especially hip-hop, because of where it comes from and how it started, is a global language, a universal language, and that film showed it to us and to me.
Well, we'll have to get you and the film down to Baltimore. That's what we're going to have to do.
Yeah.
We will.
No, we will. We'll work on that. We'll work on that together. I see Jared shaking his head yes, too, yeah, so we'll make it happen. Right, Jared?
Absolutely. I will single-handed. It's got to happen, though.
And so, Immortal, are you going to go on the next journey?
I'm sorry.
I'm going to try to.
That'll be good. What'd you say?
She said he's going.
He's going. So this has been a kind of remarkably interesting conversation I think we've had here in the last hour together. And I want this to be the beginning of many, talking about where culture hits the political forces that are fighting to change the world. I think the jazz conversation Goodman and I have next, and come back to have Harabic back with some of the folks who were in that film and bring that film here and get people to start thinking about things in different ways.
There's another one. Can I just mention very quickly?
I said no.
Right. I mean, it's your show.
You're going to
turn the man in the back to cut the mic, right, and it's over.
DJ, cut the mic.
Hip-hop.
Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I was just going to say, Hip-Hop Furious Force of Rhymes is another good movie that I just saw. I don't know that it's as good on the issue of the Israeli occupation as maybe the sister's film is, but it does talk a lot about the world use of rap music as a revolutionary force. So it's something I think is definitely worth people
it's
to check
amazing,
out.
Amazing, actually. It features my sister, actually, Shadia Mansour in Palestine, and the group I spoke of.
That's right, that's right.
So it is amazing. From MV Bill in Brazil, I believe.
And Harabic, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time here, but we will link to everybody's work here on our website. And I wanted to thank Immortal Techniques for joining us here at the last second. Good to have you with us, brother. And
thank you very much.
Harabic Tubman, co-founder of Existence is Resistance, Darius Wilmore. His book is coming out, Stereotyped Hip Hops Using Graphic Design Heroes, Heroines, and the Oral and Visual Histories of the Rap Record. And Dr. Jared Ball, Mix What I Like, a Mixtape Manifesto, who's here at Morgan State University in the Communications Department. I want to remind you, as we leave here, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program, a multidisciplinary care service dedicated to relieving symptoms and improving the quality of life of IBD patients. For more information, the number is 1-800-492-5538. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Aronson. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find out information about our guests and the work they do and their music and writing, please go to our website at steinershow.org for all those links. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.